The NATO chief says the mechanisms of security guarantees for Ukraine still remain to be decided by the Allies. Russia says U.S. pilots are violating safety protocols designed to deter a possible clash between the two countries in Syria. And a prominent Australian war veteran loses a defamation lawsuit in connection with charges of committing war crimes in Afghanistan. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. NATO Secretary General says Ukraine's security must be guaranteed when the war with Russia ends, but NATO allies still need to work out the mechanisms of that guarantee.
We don't know when the war ends, but we must ensure that when it does, we have credible arrangements in place to guarantee Ukraine's security in the future and to break Russia's cycle of aggression. The details, how this will be done, what kind of mechanisms, that remains to be decided.
Stoltenberg made the remarks following an informal meeting of NATO foreign ministers in the Norwegian capital, Oslo. The ministers debated providing security guarantees as NATO looks to bridge divisions over Ukraine's push to join the bloc. NATO requires consensus to make decisions. Joining NATO would mean all members must help defend Ukraine if attacked. An alternative being weighed is major powers offering Ukraine security assurances. Before the Thursday meeting, the German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock reiterated Berlin's position that NATO cannot be joined by a country while it is in the midst of a war.
What NATO has always made clear is the open door policy. And at the same time, it is also clear that in the middle of a war, we cannot speak about a new membership.
Foreign ministers of France and Spain echoed the call by Germany's top diplomat. They said that it would take time for members to come up with a security guarantee for Ukraine. Separately, Hungary's foreign minister voiced opposition to Ukraine joining NATO. The minister said the issue cannot be on the agenda during NATO's summit in July. He said that a timetable for Ukraine's accession should not be discussed either. Moscow has repeatedly warned against Ukraine's joining NATO. It says preventing Kiev from joining the Western military alliance remains one of the main objectives of a special military operation. Meanwhile, there appears to be no signs of a let-up in the Russia-Ukraine war, as both sides have launched fresh assaults on each other's territories. At least three people were killed in a Russian air attack on the Ukrainian capital Kiev early Thursday. Meanwhile, five people were wounded by overnight shelling of the Russian town of Shebekino that damaged several buildings as well. Two people were hospitalized as a result of the Ukrainian rocket strike. Ukraine has stepped up its attacks inside Russia, as well as in Russian-held territories in the country's eastern regions this week. Over the past couple of days, Ukrainian forces have reportedly targeted homes, a school, and industrial facilities inside Russia, leaving multiple casualties. Moscow also accused Kiev of conducting drone strikes, calling them acts of terror. Russia says the U.S. keeps violating the deconfliction protocols that were designed to deter a possible clash between forces of the two countries operating in Syria. Accusation comes from the head of the Russian Reconciliation Center for Syria. He has been quoted as saying that American pilots activate their weapon system when approaching Russian planes in eastern Syria. He describes such actions of the U.S. Air Force as gross violations of the agreed protocols. Previously, the Russian military official also condemned Washington for flying its aircraft in zones that it had agreed to not enter. Moscow has been providing aerial support to Damascus to fight terrorism. That is while the U.S. keeps maintaining its troops there without an authorization from the Syrian government. Syria accuses the U.S. of occupying its lands in order to plunder natural resources. Israeli atrocities against Palestinians seem to be never-ending as the regime refuses to consider the release of a longtime inmate, Walid Dacca, despite his advanced cancer. Last week, an Israeli court canceled a parole committee meeting that was due to consider his release. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned that the delay is an Israeli policy of slow, systematic killing of inmates. Dacca had completed his 39-year jail term in February. Last year, he was diagnosed with a rare cancer and is in urgent need of a bone marrow transplant. The news follows the recent martyrdom of another Palestinian inmate, Sheikh Khadr Adnan, who passed away after nearly 3 months of a hunger strike over his illegal detention. Israel is holding nearly 5,000 Palestinians, many of them incarcerated under the so-called administrative detention, a policy the regime pursues to keep inmates without charge or trial for an indefinite period. Israeli forces have detained dozens of Palestinians during a fresh raid on the occupied West Bank. Regime forces have raided many homes in the cities of Bethlehem, Ramallah, Nablus, and Al-Khalil. Teenagers are among 35 Palestinians detained during the assaults. Israeli forces also raided the Aqabat Jabba refugee camp in the eastern West Bank city of Ariha. Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians since the formation of a new far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The regime detains Palestinians citing different pretexts. Nearly 150 Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli attacks across the occupied territories this year so far. An Australian war veteran has lost a defamation lawsuit against some newspapers that had accused them of committing war crimes in Afghanistan. Ben Robert Smith took legal action against three newspapers and two investigative journalists for allegedly undermining his reputation. Sydney's federal court, however, has ruled that the publication successfully proved the truthfulness of reports related to the highly decorated veteran. 5 years ago, they accused Robert Smith of killing unarmed civilians, assaulting detainees, and bullying his fellow soldiers in Afghanistan. Outside of the courtroom, the winners of the case called on the Australian government to use the court's findings to investigate the crimes committed by soldiers in Afghanistan.
Now's the time for the nation and the Defence Force to absorb what the judge has found. The full findings will be released in due course. What is clear is Ben Robert Smith is a liar. I'd like Ben Robert Smith to reflect on the people he murdered, the man he kicked off a cliff, the Afghan villagers. That's what I think Ben Robert Smith should reflect on.
Robert Smith was a member of the Australian Army Special Forces, which has been embroiled in controversy over his misconduct in Afghanistan. A report published by the military in 2020 showed there was credible evidence some Australian soldiers unlawfully killed at least 50 unarmed civilians in Afghanistan. Canberra is currently investigating the incidents. Australia sent its troops to Afghanistan in 2001 as part of the so-called U.S.-led coalition against the war on terror. The country pulled its troops out of Afghanistan in 2011. Spokesman of the International Schiller Institute, Harley Schlanger, says the Australian Army's crimes against civilians in Afghanistan are only the tip of the iceberg of atrocities committed by foreigners during the war.
Well, unfortunately, the story of Ben Robert Smith is not an exception. As your news report just reported, there were many cases of civilians killed in Afghanistan. I would refer people to the WikiLeaks reports, which included 91,000 documents on the Afghan war from 2004 to 2009, in which there were written reports from soldiers and military intelligence of crimes against the civilian population. The real issue is, why has this never been brought for prosecution? Why is there no accountability? And what I would say is, while holding this one individual responsible, what about the leaders of these countries that conducted the war against Afghanistan, which continued until just 2 years ago, with many, many more casualties, and continues to extract harsh conditions on the Afghan people because of the sanctions and the theft of money? So what we're looking at is the brutal arrogance of an imperial grouping, which includes the United States and the Five Eyes countries, and should be the subject of war crimes tribunal.
Foreign ministers from the BRICS countries are meeting in South Africa as the bloc seeks to counterweight the West. South African authorities have confirmed the presence of top diplomats from Brazil, Russia, and India, as well as a Chinese deputy minister in Thursday's meeting in Cape Town. The talks are a prelude to leaders' summit to be held in Johannesburg in August. No agenda has been made public, but discussions are expected to focus on ties among members and an expansion of the group. BRICS is an acronym for five economies: Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It has gradually turned into a more cohesive geopolitical bloc. BRICS leaders have already hinted about admitting new members, including Iran and Venezuela. South Africa has invited the Iranian foreign minister to attend the meeting. Hossein Amir Abdollahian is scheduled to hold bilateral talks with his BRICS counterparts. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the possible agenda of the BRICS meeting in South Africa and its significance for global politics.
Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have John Ross, Senior Fellow at Chongyang Institute at Renmin University of China, who's joining us from Beijing. We also have Anthony Von Newkirk, Research Fellow at Wits School of Governance, joining us from Pretoria. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with John Ross in Beijing. What are you expecting to see on the agenda of this BRICS meeting? And tell us about the significance of it as well.
Well, it's extremely significant, both objectively and also from the point of its potential in the situation. I mean, the BRICS economies are going to account for more economic world growth during the next 5 years than the whole of the G7. I mean, that's not my estimate. It's the IMF's estimate, which can't be accused of being biased, particularly against the G7. Also, you've got a situation in which these economies are in general speeding up. China's economy is coming out of the COVID situation faster than it was last year. It has just posted rather good economic growth results, whereas the United States and Europe are slowing down because of the big interest rate rises. And then you've got what you might call a trend, which I think is happening in the world, which I would refer to as a new non-aligned movement, which is, you saw particularly around the question of sanctions against Russia and earlier against sanctions against Iran, the countries are just refusing to go along with the sanctions policies of the United States. They're not necessarily going to be pro-China or pro-Brazil or pro-India, but what they're not going to be is they're not going to be told what to do by the United States. So there's a political dimension here, an economic dimension, that these are the largest developing economies, and also what I would call a political development. Some people call the Global South, some people would call the new non-aligned movement, but it's basically the same process.
Mr. Van Newkirk, give us your thoughts on the significance of this BRICS meeting. As our guest in Beijing mentioned, it's not just an economic angle, but there's a political angle to this as well, a major political angle.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity and greetings to my colleague in Beijing. This afternoon in South Africa, around about 3 o'clock, the foreign ministers will have a meeting in preparation for the BRICS summit, which will take place in August in Johannesburg. Of course, there's a political angle to this because South Africa is in a diplomatic pickle or a difficulty because it is a member of the International Criminal Court and is expected to execute a warrant of arrest when President Putin arrives on our shores. So there's turmoil politically because the South African government has invited, and President Putin has agreed to attend the summit. But South Africa, the government is trying to work out how to circumvent this legal challenge brought by the ICC. It's part of a much bigger conversation, I must say, about the relevance and the value of the International Criminal Court, and from an African perspective, the question really is whether South Africa shouldn't rather promote the growth or the establishment of an indigenous court that can deal with human rights abuses on the continent. But that's part of a bigger discussion. I'm assuming for this conversation that the summit takes place in August in South Africa, in Johannesburg. All the BRICS leaders attend, including President Putin, and the agenda will then proceed with, I see, two very important issues on the table. We haven't seen the agenda. As I said, the foreign ministers are meeting today. They will set the agenda, I think. That's their job. But we know that there are two issues. The one is how to promote global development and how to promote economic recovery, particularly from the perspective of developing and emerging economies. And the second one, which everybody is looking at very eagerly, is the expansion of BRICS membership.
All right. Thanks, gentlemen. We're going to have to leave it there. John Ross, Senior Fellow at Chongyang Institute at Renmin University of China, speaking to us from Beijing. And thanks to Anthony Von Newkirk, Research Fellow at Wits School of Governance, speaking to us from Pretoria. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
China has urged the U.S. to stop official exchanges with Taiwan under the guise of trade.
China has always firmly opposed countries with which it has diplomatic relations having any form of official interaction with China's Taiwan region, including negotiating or signing any agreements with connotations of sovereignty or of an official nature. The relevant actions by the U.S. side severely contravene the One China Principle and the three U.S.-China joint communiques and go against the U.S.'s own commitment not to maintain unofficial contact with Taiwan. The DPP authorities are using trade cooperation as a pretext for using America to achieve independence.
The spokeswoman said Beijing has made several representations on this topic with Washington. China regards Taiwan as part of its territory under the One China Principle and rejects the island's diplomatic and military nexus with outside powers. The exchange of visits by American and Taiwanese officials in the recent past has infuriated Beijing. Despite repeated warnings, Washington has pledged to strengthen ties with the self-ruled island. And that is for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The debt ceiling deal announced by President Joe Biden and top congressional Republican Kevin McCarthy faces a difficult path through Congress. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Now that President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy have reached an agreement to suspend the debt ceiling and prevent the nation from defaulting on its debts, the White House and congressional leaders must convince enough lawmakers in the narrowly divided House and Senate to pass the legislation. The agreement includes spending cuts demanded by Republicans, but it is short of the reductions in the sweeping legislation passed by the GOP majority House last month. In exchange for raising the debt limit for 2 years beyond the next presidential election, a 2-year budget deal would hold spending flat for 2024 and impose limits for 2025. It also expands some work requirements for food stamp recipients and edits an environmental law to try to streamline reviews to build new energy projects. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen projected last week that the nation could default on its debt obligations by 5th of June if lawmakers do not act in time to raise the federal debt ceiling. President Biden told reporters at the White House on Sunday afternoon that he planned to call Kevin McCarthy to make sure all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. The House then released a 99-page legislative text on Sunday evening. But here's what's next in the rush to pass an agreement through Congress. Both Republicans and Democrats are expected to lose some votes, and leaders on both sides of the aisle have been telling the rank and file that neither side won everything that it wanted, as they strive to ensure that the deal has the support to pass both chambers of Congress. The president has urged both the House and the Senate to pass the agreement right away. Top White House cabinet officials and aides, including Chief of Staff Jeff Zients, Counselor of the President Steve Ricchetti, Office of Management and Budget Director Shalanda Young, and several others have been phoning and briefing lawmakers and fielding technical questions from congressional staff, according to a White House official. They have called over 60 House Democrats and briefed House and Senate Democrats, as well as the Congressional Black Caucus, with more specific briefings to come on Monday and Tuesday. Under House rules, lawmakers must have 72 hours to read the bill, and since they received it on Sunday, Wednesday is the earliest day the House can vote. Kevin McCarthy said he expects a majority of Republicans to support it, and many Democrats too, because President Biden backs the bill. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said on CBS's Face the Nation program, he expects there will be Democratic support once we have the ability to be fully briefed by the White House, but I'm not going to predict what those numbers will ultimately look like. The reaction has been mixed so far. Representative Dan Bishop of North Carolina tweeted a vomit emoji, complaining that some Republicans on the call were praising the speaker for getting what he said is almost Zippo in exchange for the debt ceiling hike. Representative Matt Rosendale, Republican of Montana, says he'll vote no. He said in a statement on Sunday, "It is frankly an insult to the American people to support a piece of legislation that continues to put our country's financial future at risk." The representative for South Dakota, Dusty Johnson, an ally of Kevin McCarthy, told CNN's State of the Union program that overwhelmingly Republicans in this conference are going to support the deal. How could they not? It's a fantastic deal. Not all Democrats appear to be on board with the agreement either. Representative Jim Himes of Connecticut said on Fox News Sunday that there is absolutely nothing for the Democrats in the bill, and he's tempted to say he'll vote no. It appears that the bill will require a strong bipartisan support to pass. Hakeem Jeffries said on Face the Nation program that he expected Republicans to produce at least 150 votes, if not more, meaning that at least 68 Democrats would also have to back it. Asked on Monday if he felt confident that the bill would pass Congress, President Biden said, "You know, I never say I'm confident with what Congress is going to do, but I feel very good about it." The Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. U.S. President Joe Biden and top congressional Republican Kevin McCarthy reached a tentative deal to suspend the federal government's $31.4 trillion debt ceiling on Saturday evening, ending a months-long stalemate. However, the deal was announced without any celebration, in terms that reflected the bitter tenor of the negotiations and the difficult path that the bill has to pass through Congress before the United States runs out of money to pay its debts in early June. I just got off the phone with the president a while ago. After he wasted time and refused to negotiate for months, we've come to an agreement in principle that is worthy of the American people, Kevin McCarthy tweeted. President Biden called the deal an important step forward in a statement, saying the agreement represents a compromise, which means not everyone gets what they want. That's the responsibility of governing. The deal would suspend the debt limit through to January of 2025, while capping spending in the 2024 and 2025 budgets, claw back unused COVID funds, speed up the permitting process for some energy projects, and include some extra work requirements for food aid programs for poor Americans. After months of back and forth, the tentative agreement came together in a flurry of phone calls. President Biden and Kevin McCarthy held a 90-minute phone call earlier on Saturday evening to discuss the deal. Kevin McCarthy briefed his members later in the evening, and the White House and the House leader spoke afterwards. "We still have more work to do tonight to finish the writing of it," Kevin McCarthy told reporters on Capitol Hill. McCarthy said he expects to finish writing the bill on Sunday, then speak to President Biden and have a vote on the deal on Wednesday. President Joe Biden and Kevin McCarthy have to carefully thread the needle in finding a compromise that can clear the House with a 222-213 Republican majority, and a Senate with a 51-49 Democratic majority, meaning it will need bipartisan support before the president can sign it into law. Negotiators have agreed to cap non-defense discretionary spending at 2023 levels for 1 year and increase it by just 1% in 2025, a source familiar with the deal said. It has historic reductions in spending, consequential reforms that will lift people out of poverty into the workforce, rein in government overreach. There are no new taxes, no new government programs, Kevin McCarthy said. The deal will avert an economically destabilizing debt default, so long as it succeeds in passing it through the narrowly divided Congress before the Treasury Department runs short of money to cover all of its debt obligations, which it warned on Friday would occur if the debt ceiling issue was not resolved by 5th of June.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather to learn more about Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. One of the most important roles that the Imams have is their responsibility to guide human beings where this guidance now extends to the inner guidance of mankind, right? This point is very beautifully described by Ayatollah Mujtaba Lari in his theological books, worth reading. It's an easy book to read. We've done many classes on this book. But you can Google this, Sayyid Mujtaba Lari, his books on theology. But one of the points that comes about is that one of the roles of the Imam is that they have been provided the ability to guide mankind based on their internal nature. And this is an important point. I want you to focus with me on this, right? What this means, and we have touched upon this previously, is that the Imams have the ability to look into the heart of every single human being, right? This is internal guidance. This is not external guidance like Sharia. Now, when we talk about these Imams, you understand that we're not only referring to the 12, we're referring to the Prophet in this, we're referring to Nabi Ibrahim in this, right? Because these are the people who have reached that station of Imamat, which is in certain understandings higher than Risala, right? But this is not excluding the best of human beings, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So they have, the Imams have this ability to look into the heart of a human being and recognize the challenges and difficulties that they are going through individually, and then based on those challenges, provide the right guidance at the right time, in the right measure, to have an effect on that individual. This is really important, okay? Because, so let me repeat that. That the Imams have the ability to look into the heart of a human being, recognize what their difficulties are, challenges are, because we all have different challenges, we all have different difficulties, right? And there, we all have different things that prevent us from following the truth, right? The truth is the truth. It's not different from person to person, but we have our own roadblocks. But the Imam has the ability to recognize that roadblock and say the right thing at the right time, in the right measure, to have the right effect for that person to then believe or climb over that hurdle. This is why, right? Like, I don't know if you've ever thought of this, but like, we have so many stories where someone insults the imam says something, and what's the result? They became a believer, right? And you're like, dude, I said the same thing, no one became a believer, right? Like, I've tried the same approach, no one accepted Islam after what I said, right? But why? Because I didn't say it in the right measure, at the right time, in the right way. Right? The Imams have that ability to look into that heart and find that out, right? So they have that ability to look at the essence of a human being. And what that means is then, and this brings us to a really important point, is that the Imams, or the maqam of Imamat, is that they have the ability to see the inner reality of human beings. Yeah? That which we sometimes masquerade, we put a mask on it, we put a fake surah, fake picture on it to hide what's really in our hearts, right? The challenges in our hearts, sometimes the hypocrisy in our hearts, sometimes the lack of understanding or belief in our hearts. And so the Imams, because of this gift that they've been given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, have the ability to look into the heart of a human being and see whether or not there is any light left in that heart, right? And if there is any light that is left in that heart, they can tap into that light to bring you into more light. Yeah? But what that means is that we have to have some light, isn't it? Yeah. Because if our hearts are of that nature where there doesn't exist a light anymore, then those are the people the Imam would not guide. Not that they won't be able, there's nothing left in them to guide, right? This idea is not something that we just make up. You know, we have very beautiful traditions. For example, one by a companion by the name of Abdullah bin Jundab says that kataba ilayhi ar-ridha, that it was written, a letter was written to him by our 8th Imam ar-ridha alayhi salam. Allahumma salli ala ali Muhammad. Where the Imam says, "Amma ba'd," that after he wrote the introduction, he says, "And after that, فَإِنَّ النَّبِيِّ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَآلِهِ كَانَ أَمِينَ اللَّهِ فِي خَلْقِهِ," that the Prophet was the one who looks after the affairs, the trustee of the people. فَلَمَّا قُبِذَ كُنَّ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ وَرَثَتَهُ فَنَحْنُ أُمَنَاءُ اللَّهِ. He says, but after he was taken back, we the Ahlul Bayt became the Umana of Allah, the trustees of Allah. And then he begins to describe the knowledge they have. He says, إِنَّنَا عِلْمَ الْبَلَايَ وَالْمَنَايَ وَأَنْسَابُ الْعَرَبُ وَمَوْلِيدُ الْإِسْلَامِ. That we have the knowledge of the sufferings and death, genealogy and history. But then he says something really beautiful. He says, وَإِنَّا لَنَعْرِفُ الرَّجُلِ إِذَا رَأَيْنَاهُ بِحَقِيقَةِ الْإِيمَانِ وَحَقِيقَةِ النِّفَاقِ. Yeah? He says, and we have the knowledge that when we look at someone, we can tell whether they have the reality of Iman or the reality of Nifaq in their hearts. Yeah? Subhanallah. Right? That they have that ability. Now that in one way is quite amazing, because it's an amazing thing. But it's quite nerve-wracking too. Yeah? It has to be nerve-wracking. Because we're all saying, the Imam will come. We're waiting for the Imam to come. But is our heart ready for the Imam to say, is this a believer or not? Yeah? Is this a person who has light or not? And so this is something that brings us to a really important responsibility on our end. We have talked about the position of Imam, the responsibility of the Imam, and now we come to our responsibility. That our responsibility is that we need to ensure that our faith is of that level, that there exists light in our hearts because of that faith. Because if there is no light, I won't be able to, number one, recognize my Imam when my Imam comes, because it's the light of the heart that recognizes his light. Yeah. But number two, there won't be anything for the Imam to tap into, to bring me into that light. We should be more like the Prophet, and that is to be good-natured with the people. You know, the level of jahalat that the Prophet faced was unmatching to anyone else. Yet, the Prophet had this akhlaq that if you read any books of sunnah, sunnah meaning the sunnah of the Prophet, be it Shia or Sunni books, what they will tell you is that the Prophet had a characteristic where anyone who met the Prophet any time would fall in love with the Prophet. They may not have known anything about the Prophet, yeah? But after any amount of interaction with the Prophet, they would fall in love with the Prophet. Why? Because the Prophet had that level of akhlaq, right? You read these lengthy descriptions about the Prophet where he wouldn't stretch his legs when he would talk to someone. Right? Read the book Sunan al-Nabi. It's translated by Sheikh Tahir Rida Jafar. That one of the most beautiful things that I tried to emulate in the Prophet's life is the Prophet would engage in small talk with everyone. Yeah, with everyone. It's an amazing quality. You know, sometimes we meet people, they want to talk about something, I have zero interest in that. So I just tune them out. I go to my phone and I start, hi. Yeah? When I have no interest in that conversation, right? The Prophet would never do that. Companions say that if someone talked about the weather, he would talk about the weather. Someone talked about business, he would talk about business. Someone would talk about home life, he would give advice. Whatever it is that that person found important at that moment, the Prophet found that subject important. It's a beautiful characteristic, yeah? But if we can learn that, then we have the sunnah of the Prophet, to be good-mannered, just so that when people leave us, they're not annoyed at us.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, more than 500,000 appointments and operations have been cancelled due to the strikes by doctors, nurses and paramedics. Specialist doctors in England are demanding an increase in their visiting fees and say that these wages have been lower than annual inflation for a long time. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. National Health Service bosses are braced for a summer of chaos after UK's union leaders suggested a 50% pay hike would not be enough to stop senior doctors from striking. In comments unearthed by The Daily Mail, officials from Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, BMA, said, if ministers were to offer consultants 50%, it would still be just a drop in the ocean. This is despite NHS consultants already earning an average of £128,000 a year and the union separately demanding a 35% pay rise for junior doctors. The comments from Vishal Sharma and Mike Henley, chairman and deputy chairman of the British Medical Association's Consultants Committee, threatened to escalate the bitter dispute between ministers and health unions. Disputes with nurses and junior doctors remain unresolved in England, raising the prospect of all three coordinating strikes for the first time. Unlike nurses and junior doctors, consultants are yet to strike, but more than 30,000 are being balloted and look certain to vote in favour of industrial action after 86% did so in a test ballot in March. The vote closes at the end of June. In comments made on the little-known Senior Review podcast, Dr. Vishal Sharma said, we now need to start from scratch and say what should a doctor in the United Kingdom in 2023 be paid. We can argue that it should be 50% higher. The government can argue whatever it should be. And I have to say, even 50% is still a drop in the ocean compared to America, Australia and many other places. Dr. Mike Henley added, when you consider the 17 years of training, the stress, difficulty and complexity of what you do, you're worth every penny. Dr. Mike Henley added, so the question to you lot is, what do we do? Do we go on Newsnight and say, we demand a 50% increase? Well, I would, obviously. Britain's Health Secretary Steve Barclay on Sunday, 28th of May, held firm on the government's position, saying it would not improve its pay offer to nurses, which includes a one-off payment equivalent to 2% of salaries in the 2022-2023 financial year, and a 5% rise for the 2023-2024 financial year. It was rejected by members of the Royal College of Nursing last month, despite the union's boss, Pat Cullen, recommending that members should accept the offer. The Royal College of Nursing is already balloting its 300,000 members for further strike action over the next 6 months. When asked by Sky News whether the government would resume talks with the union, Health Secretary Steve Barclay said, "Not on the amount of pay. Talks with the British Medical Association over junior doctors' pay have also broken down after the union rejected a 5% offer," with Steve Barclay telling the BBC on Sunday, "They haven't moved from 35%. That's the key." Dr. Vivek Trivedi, the co-chairman of the British Medical Association's Junior Doctors Committee, said, "We've been very consistent in what we're wanting, and that's to restore the pay doctors have lost over the past 15 years, which is roughly 35% up to April of last year." In response to his podcast comment, Dr. Sharma said, "Consultants have quite simply had enough, and this is why we're being forced to ballot for industrial action." A health department spokesman said, "We urge the British Medical Association to carefully consider the likely impact of any industrial action on patients." Dame Helen Stokes-Lampard, chair of the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges, said the decisions were clinically led and first and foremost about improving the quality of healthcare. She said, "I know the team have consulted with medical experts, specialist clinicians, those who commission services, and a great number of patient groups every step of the way." She added, "Achieving consensus has not always been easy, but it has been worth it. The fact that the programme also reduces unwarranted variation across the country and helps to tackle the backlog as well as freeing valuable clinical time are also huge bonuses." But general practitioner GP leaders are worried about the knock-on effect that this will have on family doctors already struggling to cope with increasing demand. Dr. Margaret Igbo of the Royal College of GPs raised concerns that the changes could overload family doctors. She said plans to reduce the pressure on hospitals cannot be implemented in isolation without considering the impact on general practice and the huge workload and workforce pressures that GPs and their teams are facing. The British newspaper The Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Junior doctors will strike for at least 3 days every month over the summer after new pay talks with the government broke down as they upped their pay demands to 49%. The British Medical Association, the BMA, which has been demanding a 35% pay rise, said the government's offer of 5%, which was also offered to nurses and paramedics, was not credible. The junior doctors will now walk out for 72 hours from 7 a.m. local time on Wednesday, 14th of June, to 7 a.m. local time on Saturday, 17th of June. But a Department of Health source said the union had unrealistic expectations and had not only refused to shift during negotiations, but actually demanded more. It is understood the British Medical Association negotiators proposed a multi-year settlement, which would have seen doctors below the rank of consultant receive a 49% boost between 2021 and 2024. The strikes are likely to undermine efforts to tackle record waiting lists and leave patients waiting longer for care. Over 500,000 appointments and operations have so far been cancelled as a result of NHS industrial action by the likes of doctors, nurses and paramedics. Junior doctors held a 4-day strike in April and a 3-day strike in March, which caused the cancellation of 370,000 appointments and operations. Around 1 million NHS staff on the agenda for change contract, which includes most employees other than doctors and dentists, have accepted an offer of a 5% pay rise and a one-off bonus payment.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Here is a part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with Iranian commanders and senior military officials in the Imam Khomeini Hosseini on April 16, 2023. Stopping is like moving backwards. There is no difference. Do not be satisfied with the status quo. Strive to move forward. Now I have already spoken about the meaning of change. Change is the upper point of this movement. What's required is movement. We need to move forward and make progress. Look and see what you can do in this regard in the department that you are working in. Another important point is preparedness. Now he made a reference to war games. they are important, that is, conducting war games in the fields that the enemy's armed forces are engaged in all fields, including the air, ground, maritime, infiltration, and security sectors. You need to be prepared in all the fields that fall within the scope of the tasks of the armed forces. When there is a threat, preparation must be made. Threats are always there, because you can never assume that there will not be a threat. It may be possible to imagine a time when there will be peace and no war, but to assume that there will be a time when threats won't exist, in my opinion, such a thing is impossible and will not come about. Therefore, we must always be prepared. This is the verse in the Holy Quran. Prepare against them whatever you can. Chapter 8, verse 60.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In other words, be prepared. How much should one prepare? Whatever you can, whatever you are capable of, military power and war horses. This preparedness, the preparation itself, is a deterrent. Being prepared is a deterrent. Therefore, in this same verse, God states, you instill awe in them because of your numbers, because of your preparation, awing thereby the enemy of Allah and your enemy. This is again chapter 8 of the Holy Quran, verse 60. In other words, when you are prepared and the enemy senses this, this in itself is a deterrent. It is a deterrent in the Air Force. It is a deterrent in the defense sector. It is a deterrent in maritime exercises. And it is a deterrent in the military exercises and drills that you conduct at sea and on land. It is the same in all the various sectors. Therefore, maintain your preparedness so that the enemy can see it. This threat that I spoke about, where is it coming from? This is also an important point. We must not make mistake about this. This threat that I mentioned, where is it coming from? This is also an important point. We must not make any mistakes.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.